I'm crazy about you, Madeline. Madeline. You don't know how I wanted to call you that. Madeline, I love you. It's hit me all of a sudden, I love you. And when you wake up, I'm going to take you in my arms and I'm going to kiss you. I'm going to tell you that.
Did you say something, Mr. Bradley?
Welcome to Season 5 of How Would Lubitsch Do It, a podcast in which we discuss the works of director Ernst Lubitsch, one film at a time. It's 1936, and Imogen Sarah Smith joins us to discuss Desire. Come visit ErnstCast.com if you'd like show notes, resources as to where you might find the films we'll be discussing, a link to our Discord, or just to say hi. Welcome back, everyone. We are here with Imogen Sarah Smith. Welcome, Imogen.
Hi, it's great to be here. I'm Imogen Sarah Smith. I'm a freelance film writer and historian. I am the author of two books, Buster Keaton, The Persistence of Comedy, and In Lonely Places, Film Noir Beyond the City. I've written for Film Comment, Sight and Sound, the Criterion Collection. I also have done a lot of commentaries for the Criterion Channel and some programming and taught film criticism and film history at NYU, School of Visual Arts, and Maine Media Workshop. And I am the editor-in-chief of Noir City Magazine. I think that's enough about me, except that I am also a great lover of Lubitsch.
Yeah, we're here at an interesting juncture in Lubitsch's career. You might have noticed, dear listeners, that 2 years have passed since the previous film we've covered on the show, and that is a really long time in Hollywood in the 30s, and a really long time in Lubitsch's career because, you know, at this point he's been making up to 4 films a year, usually 1 or 2, and this is not even a film that is directed by Lubitsch, and no, that's because he has become production head of Paramount. And so, as I've probably mentioned a repetitive amount of times on the show, he was the only director in studio Hollywood history to become an executive at a major studio. And with it came a lot of tumult. His tenure only lasted a year, from early 1935 to early 1936. And this film was Desire, directed by Frank Borzage, was one of the only films he kind of fully produced from start to finish that he was happy with. It's the only film that really bears his hallmark coming out of that experience. He partially produced a number of others, but this is kind of the one we have as, okay, this is what a Lubitsch production without Lubitsch the director, except for maybe a few scenes, looks like. Although he did produce Dangerous Curves, but he wasn't yet an executive at that point in 1929, starring Clara Bow. And so, you know, this period in Lubitsch's life was, as I mentioned, tumultuous. He had to deal with folks like Joseph von Sternberg. You know, he ended up forcibly retitling Sternberg's final film with Paramount, The Devil is a Woman. He also had a few successes. He had Hands Across the Table rewritten for Carol Lombard in light of her stunning success as a kind of a screwball heroine or anti-heroine in the 20th century. So it was a busy time. He also lost his German citizenship, or more accurately, it was stripped from him by the hated Nazis. And by the time Desire came out in 36, he had become an American citizen. So much is going on in his life.
You have kind of said this about just how unusual this was. And I think it's been said that probably at no other studio besides Paramount would this ever have happened, that they would actually have put a director, a creative filmmaker in this executive position. Paramount was notoriously one of the more chaotic studios that was known for not being well run, also known for being the one that was most often in a state of financial crisis, and it had several kind of brushes with bankruptcy. So it's kind of that thing where they're just trying something. And then there's the interesting question, of course, of why Lubitsch wanted to do this. And he himself said he just wanted to see what it was all about, that it was sort of curiosity. He actually said, like Alice in Wonderland, like he kind of wanted to go down this rabbit hole of figuring out what production was like. And, you know, it clearly was a mistake on all sides. And it's kind of a waste of a great director to be in this production capacity. And he had this real desire to have true creative input and control over everything that the studio was producing, which was obviously kind of impossible. But it's an interesting light on his character, just that he had that curiosity and that interest to try to do this. He did say that, you know, Desire was the only one of his films that he really kind of fully produced, he was involved in. The story, the casting, you know, all aspects of creating this film. And of course, it's just, it's of the films that he produced, the one that is probably the easiest to imagine him directing. It is a story that seems like a good fit for him. And it was largely because he did not have time to direct it because he was busy producing that he gave it to Borzaghi. And Borzaghi was one of at least three directors whom he brought to the studio. That was part of also what he contributed during this time. He signed Borzaghi and Louis Milestone and King Vidor. So that's interesting just to know that Borzaghi was obviously someone that he admired and wanted to work with. And maybe a way into this is to talk about the kind of similarities and differences between them as directors.
And Borzaghi was remarkably well-liked, wasn't he?
Yes, I think so, by everyone. And he had been around for quite a while at this point. He was still probably best known for some of the silent films that he made at Fox, Seventh Heaven and Street Angel and Lucky Star, these kind of supremely romantic silent films. And he's also someone who is very consistent throughout his career in what the themes that are associated with him. I mean, the fact that he's always labeled as, you know, Hollywood's great romantic is one of those cases where the label really is correct. I mean, you can't really argue with that. But the great theme of his films is really the redemptive power of love. And love in his films often has an even sort of miraculous quality and an ability to transform people and to redeem people. And that is actually something you see in Desire, even though it is this kind of sophisticated comedy. In a way, the kind of story of the film is the first half is very Lubitsch, and the second half is very Borzaghi.
The tone really shifts in the second half. And Lubitsch, I would say, despite being, in my opinion at least, maybe the Earth's preeminent romantic comedy directors in cinema, he wasn't, I would call a romantic. He was focused on often the transactional nature of relationships. This film is about two people who kind of transcend their almost mortal earthly desires to kind of fulfill this kind of transcendental romance.
Romantic comedy is so fascinating as a genre precisely because there's this kind of tension at the heart of it. Because romance and comedy, even though we think of this as a very natural fit, in a way are not always a natural, or there is this tension that is what is interesting, that is what gives a kind of charge to these movies, because comedy often comes from, you know, a place of knowingness and of either of sophistication, sometimes of cynicism, sometimes even of sort of, there can be a very cruel edge to comedy. Sometimes it is about, you know, this certain way of looking at things that is often kind of at odds with a romantic way of looking things at things, which can be idealizing, which can be very, you know, about the creation of this kind of illusion, which is often punctured by comedy. And so the most interesting, and I completely agree with you about Lubitsch, and I think what you see in Lubitsch and, you know, in Preston Sturges is this constant kind of push and pull between this wised up quality of comedy and this sort of the sense of romance and desire. And obviously Borzaghi is very much on the romantic side. And as I say, he didn't direct a lot of comedies. So I do think this film ultimately winds up in it being more sort of straightforwardly romantic than what you would find in Lubitsch. I mean, Lubitsch is not cynical, but there is this sophistication and this kind of sense of being a realist about what people are actually like and what relationships really are about, and the fact that people are fickle and they're not necessarily going to stay forever with one person and this kind of thing that, you know, you find in Lubitsch's films that you are not going to find in the films of Borzaghi. It works, I think, in this film, but there's definitely a sense of they're not coming from the same place. And Borzaghi also is American, which also, of course, these, in a sense, Dietrich and Gary Cooper in this film are also representing, you know, these kind of heightened almost not caricatures, but the sort of stylized versions of the sophisticated European and the sort of naive, but ultimately, you know, strong and sort of morally down to earth American. So you're also getting that kind of combination, that hybrid in the film itself.
The kind of dynamics between Cooper and Dietrich actually recalled to me more than anything else, the kind of logic of the screwball comedy in a funny way, even though this film tonally is very low resemblance to that genre. But that kind of dynamic of the, you know, it is revealed to be working class, you know, kind of gruff down to earth American guy, almost taming this ethereal European faux aristocrat in this case. But it felt very different. It ends with them, you know, going to Detroit or whatever, and their trip to Detroit, which doesn't sound all that amazing as an ending. But their trip to Detroit contrasts with, you know, the Lubitsch film that ends with another transcontinental movement, which is Clooney Brown, where, you know, Clooney Brown, it ends with Belinsky and Clooney going to New York. And it's this kind of giddy thing where it's Belinsky gets to keep being Belinsky, the European aesthete in New York. But in this, it almost feels like the mechanics resemble that kind of screwball, okay, middle-class American is the way to go type of almost morality.
First of all, just to mention Samuel Hoffenstein, which is one of the three writers credited on Desire, also worked on Clooney Brown ultimately. Mm-hmm. So there is a connection between those movies. I mean, I think, yes, that's where it kind of ultimately winds up, is with the sort of triumph of the working class American. But where it starts is also another thing that I think is one of the central themes of screwball comedy and of just romantic comedy in the 1930s, which is this meeting of innocence and experience, you know, of the person who is wised up, who is often kind of morally compromised, you know, the con artist or just the person who is kind of sophisticated and cynical, and then this sort of naive, innocent, down-to-earth, good person. And it is almost always the way it is here, which is that the wised up person is the woman. And of course, the innocent is the man. And yes, it is always in these films that experience is seduced by innocence, and that finally, in the end, it is sort of innocence that triumphs. But first, you know, that person is often humiliated and sort of taken around the block by the experienced person. This is, of course, you know, the Lady Eve, and a lot of other comedies of this era have that kind of meeting of the wised up and of the kind of innocent person. So you see that here, certainly with the American abroad, the American in Europe.
And it's interesting, this might be a good segue into Dietrich and how this interfaces with her persona. When we last left Dietrich, she was working with Von Sternberg, who, aside from being widely considered one of the most tiresome personalities in Hollywood, is one of my favorite directors, and has become one. We last saw her, you know, in Scarlet Empress, Devil is a Woman, Shanghai Express, playing, you know, what has been called by many one variation or another of like an icy character who almost floats above the movie, right? You know, she exists on her own plane of existence, her own dimension. She doesn't bother with us mortals. She is so removed from the down-to-earth character she would maybe later play in something like Destry Rides Again. This is an interesting transitional work.
You know, the arc of Dietrich's career up to this point, she had come to Hollywood in 1930 after having made The Blue Angel with Von Sternberg in Germany. But Morocco, her first American film, is, of course, with Gary Cooper as her leading man. So they have already appeared together. But she goes from being this incredible sensation when she first appears, and through really Shanghai Express, which I think is the most successful, most popular of the Dietrich Sternberg films, she becomes a huge star and a huge sensation. And then very rapidly, over the next few films, really loses that popularity. And it's always said, you know, because the films become too stylized, you know, she becomes this almost not human figure. Her look in the films becomes more and more extreme, more and more stylized. Her characters become more and more, as you say, icy. They become these kind of femme fatales. Her whole demeanor becomes more and more kind of frozen and hieratic. And, you know, it's she and Sternberg are kind of taking this persona that they've created and this whole kind of Gesamtkunstwerk that they're creating, and they're pushing it to the furthest extreme until it becomes The Devil is a Woman. And of course, nowadays, there are many people who love these films. But at the time, it became, there was this whole sort of meta story about the need to save Dietrich and how could Dietrich's career be saved. So the idea of Desire is it's her first American comedy. And the whole idea that Lubitsch had was show that she has a sense of humor, put her back in a somewhat more down-to-earth, more human situations, pair her again with Gary Cooper, with someone who can sort of be an equal partner to her, because also in the later Sternberg films, it becomes more and more about her sort of destroying men and pairing her with men who are kind of in no way her equals. So the whole point of Desire was to try to turn around her career. And in a way, she is very funny. She is very charming. It was sort of recognized that she was showing this other part of her persona, but it did not, in fact, really do the trick. And she continued through, you know, Angel, which is her film with Lubitsch the following year. And through the, you know, almost the remainder of the decade, she's kind of in this low period in her career. And it is Destry Rides Again that finally is the film that revitalizes her career and is her big comeback film. But yeah, it's a kind of a turning point. It's the first time that she is, you know, in a sense, still playing the same kind of character. She still has the same kind of glamorous look, but it's all with a little bit of a wink, with this sense of her lightness, of her charm, of her wit. And of course, finally, with this idea that she's going to get married and go off to Detroit, which, yes, I find a little hard to picture. Not sure how much she's going to enjoy living in Detroit as the wife of an auto engineer, but that's Hollywood romantic comedy for you.
That is the knock against the film that I most agree with, is that the ending, there's a few reasons. I mean, we'll talk about the haze of it all, but this film really, I think, works to undercut, or even undercut's too strong a word, but it works to kind of tweak Dietrich's persona in a couple of ways. And the first is that comedic vein. But the other way is that thing that kind of disarms me about her character most in this film is that she sincerely falls in love completely, in a way that you can't imagine any of her Sternberg characters really doing, even in something like Shanghai Express, where the romance between her and the male lead, who I and everyone else on earth forget the name of.
Clive Brett.
Yes. There's a bit more convenience there.
The Sternberg films, the first three of them, at least, actually the first four, are all about her sacrificing herself ostensibly for love for a man. You know, she goes off into the desert following the Foreign Legion in Morocco, and she, you know, is shot at the end of Dishonored to save this other spy. And yet it's like the plot is telling us that supposedly she loves these men so much and that she's sacrificing herself. But as you say, it's not something you actually feel. Mm-hmm. It's sort of, that's the plot vehicle. But what the movie is really all about is just giving Dietrich this opportunity to be this goddess who you never really feel has that kind of vulnerability, that she is actually in love in any kind of human way. And I think that's part of what ultimately hurt her persona in the Sternberg films, is that he wasn't really interested in seeing her do that. And so, yes, I think you do see it and feel it in a way in Desire that you don't in any of the earlier films.
Dishonored, I think, is a particularly good comparison here, where that might be the Sternberg film that most hinges on a decision made by her character, ostensibly out of love for the Victor McLaughlin character. But both times I've watched that film, I've read it more as a desire to almost turn her life into a romantic narrative. It's the same reason why she, quote-unquote, sacrifices herself for the enemy spy in that film. It's the same reason why she puts on lipstick before getting shot, right? It's because it's a better fit for her.
Yes, it's always about her performance, and in somewhat in the same way that I feel is a bit with Garbo too, that there she has a kind of a solitude on the screen because there's just nobody else who seems to be even kind of occupying the same plane that she is. It's like she's kind of from another planet. And she doesn't, in most of these films, have any real chemistry. I mean, certainly in Shanghai Express, I mean, she has chemistry with Anna May Wong. She does not really have any chemistry with Clive Brook.
No.
And it's often been said that after Morocco, von Sternberg didn't want to cast her opposite a leading man that she might have that kind of chemistry with, possibly out of jealousy, or it just, that was not what he wanted in the films. And so, yes, the latter part of Desire, when they really get, you know, when you really see them together, is not something you had seen her before. You had either seen her as this figure who destroys men, which she is in The Blue Angel and in the last two Sternberg films, or as you say, sort of playing out this drama of romantic sacrifice that seems to be about her in some way, but not really about her relationship with a man.
And this one, she goes to Detroit in order to love.
Well, that's possibly a sacrifice.
Yeah, yeah.
But while we're talking about this idea of her, this sort of shift in her persona, I do want to make sure we bring up John Gilbert.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, John Gilbert was supposed to be cast as the character Carlos, who's ultimately played by John Halliday. And Gilbert, who, of course, famously was Greta Garbo's lover, was a great, you know, a great star in the silent era. We don't need to go too much into the whole sort of myth about his voice and the idea that he was ruined by having a bad voice, which is not really true. Actually, I like some of his talkies very much. But anyway, he was also an alcoholic. So he's gone into a kind of a decline at this point, both a career decline and a personal decline. And his relationship with Garbo was over. And he was Dietrich's lover at this point. And of course, Dietrich famously was this kind of nurturing, motherly person who kind of liked to have this sort of project of somebody that she could take care of. And she really, you know, kind of wanted to pull Gilbert out of this and to get him to stop drinking. And anyway, they were together at the time. Gilbert was supposed to play this character of Carlos. Ultimately, he had a series of heart attacks, seemingly brought on by his starting to drink again. But anyway, his health was too fragile. So he's replaced by John Halliday, whom Stephen Bach, Dietrich's biographer, describes as a kind of Adolphe Monjou without the charm, which I think is kind of a good description of him. It would have been a very, very different situation if it had been Gilbert playing this character, because I think we would have felt that there was potentially something between Madeline and Carlos. They are partners in crime, but in the movie as it stands, although he is maybe interested in her, I don't think we ever feel that there's actually ever been anything between them.
It feels almost paternal, their relationship. She's almost like a mentee to him. It's very sexless.
It is very. And I mean, there is this line where she reassures Carlos and says, I am as about Tom, the Cooper character, to say that she is not, nothing is going on, because he's always warning her, don't mix romance and business. And she says, I'm as interested in him as I am in you. And that's sort of her way of saying, you know, there's nothing there, which of course is not ultimately true. But anyway, Gilbert wrote some sort of memos to Dietrich about how to play this part. And he said, remember, keep alive, no placidity in scenes, no white mystery, no ghost. So he's sort of saying, like, stop doing this ethereal kind of ice queen thing, and you need to be more natural, you need to be more human. So it's kind of, you know, it's a sad thing that he wasn't able to do this, and he did not live very much longer after this. So it's the turning point for Dietrich, but it doesn't quite take in her career until a few years later.
There are many things that are present in this film that would become, you know, a little less present in this way in later films with Dietrich. I mean, one example is that the costume design by Travis Bent. And it feels almost any one of these costumes could have been in the Sternberg films in various points, and they would have felt at home. They are incredible.
Well, Banton had designed the costumes for all of the Sternberg films. Mm-hmm. And Travis Banton was the head designer at Paramount at this time. He is, of course, ultimately replaced by Edith Head. But he had a very close relationship with Dietrich. She loved him. She loved his designs. They worked very closely together. It wasn't just like he was going off and designing something for her. They would go and spend hours and hours and hours together on these fittings. They would select fabrics and feathers and furs and things together. And it was really kind of a collaboration. And she was famous for sort of her patience and her stoicism. The creation of her look through clothes, through makeup, through lighting, that was her creation. And of course, there's much discussion about, you know, who was really responsible and to what extent did Sternberg sort of invent this look. But I think ultimately she took responsibility for it. And, you know, Banton's designs for her take advantage of, you know, it's like not every woman could wear these designs. You know, they're very extravagant, There's a lot of big feathers and a lot of her face being partially covered, which really works perfectly for this kind of character that she's playing, who is always, you know, as a con artist, is always involved in seduction and deception in various ways. So the clothes in this film are a little bit less extreme, and her whole look is a little bit less extreme than it was in, say, The Devil is a Woman. But it's still very much that heavy-duty glamour that you get with Banton and Dietrich. And of course, Banton and Hans Dreyer, who's the art director, are two of the people who had the most to do with the kind of look of Paramount films at this time. I mean, they worked on almost everything that came out of the studio at that time, and they had to create this particular kind of elegance and this kind of gleam that you get in those Paramount films of the 30s. So these are some of the reasons why, as much as Paramount was this kind of studio that was a mess and chaotic and was always kind of struggling financially, when you think of Paramount in the 30s, you think of it as having this brand, which was this kind of sophistication and a kind of elegance and glamour that was unique and distinctive to the studio.
That also, you know, extends to Charles Lang's lighting of her, which, I mean, Dietrich was famously involved with the cinematography of any shot involving her. And, you know, whatever form that collaboration took between Lang, Borzage, and her in terms of crafting those images, they are incredibly striking in a way that almost doesn't quite desert the film when she's off screen. But it's, I think, notable that almost all the most striking images are of her in this movie.
Yes.
For all we're talking about Dietrich, you know, we don't want to neglect Gary Cooper, who I will admit this is the second of three films of which he prominently features that we're going to talk about in the show. The previous one being Design for Living, and the next one being Bluebeard's Eighth Wife, which is significantly less remembered than Design for Living. But one of the interesting kind of to me little side stories of this show is, I think, at least seeing Gary Cooper learn how to act, because it is really interesting to me that someone like Kay Francis got widespread, at least among contemporaneous critics at the time, slightly denigrated for acting talents, unfairly, I think, in comparison to Gary Cooper, who seemed to get a free pass for what I think are some questionable roles. And I think this is one of his better roles. I quite enjoy his chemistry with Dietrich, especially. They have a good mix of styles.
Cooper had a lot of doubts about Design for Living, I think. He felt that this, you know, this kind of sophisticated comedy didn't feel right for him. I mean, I really like Design for Living, and I think he works in that. I think his performance works in that film. But you can see maybe some of that discomfort. Mm-hmm. I think we still, when you think of Gary Cooper today, think mostly of the kind of Western roles, the very laconic persona that he had in things like High Noon and, you know, Man of the West. And that, I think, is what he kind of felt most comfortable with. But in the 30s, he has this period where he's in quite a few comedies, most famously, you know, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, which he makes shortly after this. I have to be honest that Cooper does not always work for me in comedies. Mm-hmm. I don't think he had a really natural comic gift. And at the beginning of this film, I feel like he is trying a little too hard to be comical, and he kind of mugs and he makes faces and he, you know, he does this kind of goofy stuff that feels a little bit forced to me. However, I think he had amazing chemistry with Dietrich. And once they get together, that's when his performance really starts to work better for me. And I think just this sort of physicality that they have together, you know, is very believable. He's not my favorite comedy. He's not my favorite screwball comedy leading man. However, Lubitsch obviously liked him. I mean, he sort of persuaded him to make Design for Living. He obviously wanted him to be in this film. And I think he was very open to working with Dietrich again. Cooper was not a fan of Sternberg, as most actors were not. So the idea of being able to act with Dietrich without having to be directed by Joseph von Sternberg was appealing to him. So yeah, I think that, you know, they obviously, the great difference in their styles and the difference in their personas in this film is sort of the whole point. She has this kind of smooth and suave and always being kind of in control in the earlier part of the film. But you need an actor in this role who you can believe would actually, after being the sort of victim of all her machinations, she would genuinely fall in love with in the way that she does. So I think that part of it works. I know that I'm probably in the minority in my opinion about Cooper in comedies, but I'm not crazy about the Cooper Capra films. I think he can be very corny in those.
I'm likewise in that minority. I also think that Lubitsch in general, if there's one thing about his films going back, aside from his questionable grasp on the melodrama, that I think, if I have a criticism for even some of his good films, it's that I think his taste in casting some of the, you know, it's a young, straight in the sense of the comedic straight man, male leads, was occasionally and often sometimes consistently a bit more questionable than his casting in other areas, where even back in his Berlin period, Harry Liebke, who was, you know, the young romantic lead in many, many of his films at that point, was almost always the weakest element of them. And I think oftentimes his best versions of that were like Robert Stack in To Be or Not to Be, where it was a total subversion of that, where he's just so far into to being an absolute naive fool that he is very entertaining and fun in that movie. But I do think that I may be unfairly lumping Gary Cooper into that pile, where I find, okay, so Lubitsch was great at casting women, period. He was great at casting rakish middle-aged and older men. But in terms of like 20, 30-something conventionally handsome young men who were more sincere, he was not necessarily the most reliable director in Hollywood.
I think I would agree with that.
One thing we should mention is that Cooper and Dietrich were, around the time of this, they were in a relationship.
What I have often read, so she's with John Gilbert, you know, sort of taking care of him, and she's gotten him to stop drinking. And then she, you know, she's going to start making this film. You know, she starts having something going on with Gary Cooper, and that this is possibly what spurred Gilbert. This is John Gilbert's daughter, I think, said at this point he started drinking again because he saw that Dietrich had gone off with Gary Cooper. So yes, I believe that to be true. We might want to mention a few other people in the cast.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite performances in this actually is Zeffie Tilbury.
Oh, she's terrific.
As Aunt Olga, who appears in the latter part of the film. And she's, it's not a very large part, but there's a wonderful thing that I love about early and mid 1930s Hollywood, which is these great roles for older actresses, you know, mm-hmm. Marie Dressler, Alison Skipworth, Mae Robeson, you know, Edna Mae Oliver. They get these great parts that are funny and strong and often a little sort of, you know, they're sometimes playing something like a con artist, or, you know, some sort of the exact opposite of the sort of stereotype of women, older women being pushed into these motherly or grandmotherly roles. They've got a lot of style. They've got a lot of wit. She comes on, Aunt Olga comes on here, and she has all these great lines about brandy is the only thing I'm straight about. And, you know, these kind of raffish sort of lines. She was an English actress, Zeffie Tilbury, although she did a lot of different things in Hollywood. I mean, she plays Grandma Joad in The Grapes of Wrath a few years later. There's a very brief appearance by Akeem Tamiroff as a police officer. So there's some good performances in the secondary roles as well.
I especially enjoyed Ernest Cosart. He's going to show up a couple more times. He's a typical variation on his usual role, which is this slightly fussy, in this case, a jeweler. And he's a typical pro in that he knows exactly what his assignment is and hits every comic beat perfectly. His growing awareness of what's going on when he is being scammed is just so, he milks every drop out of it. His every line delivery he gives, I just kind of treasure.
You owe me 2,200,000 francs. I have given the pearls to your wife, and I think you are crazy.
That's bad.
And I think Alan Mowbray is wonderful as well. And their scene together is wonderful. This is all in the early part of the film during this wonderfully elaborate jewel heist, which involves Dietrich's character tricking each of these men, the jeweler and then this psychiatrist, into thinking that the other man is her husband. And ultimately, you know, this is how she gets a hold of the pearls and disappears while they are sitting mm-hmm. together, gradually figuring out what is going on. But Alan Mowbray, who also has this wonderful kind of unctuous quality playing this doctor. And just, I love the kind of leisureliness of those scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the pacing of this film is never snappy. It kind of takes its time, and maybe it's a little bit more Borzage-y than Lubitsch in that regard. But it is the kind of film that lets us enjoy being with these people. And it's not, even as it is ultimately becoming a kind of a road movie, it's never, you know, hurrying us on to the next thing. And it gives these people their kind of time to unfurl these wonderful performances.
It does kind of throw John Holliday's relative weakness into relief, where he is maybe sixth down the list of characters that I would remember from this movie.
He is definitely the least appealing and least interesting character, and possibly to a degree that's necessary, in that he is representing what she ultimately has to reject. Maybe it would be more interesting if you felt like there was more for her to choose from. But I think having him be this kind of cold fish character makes it seem pretty easy for her to make this choice. Of course, Aunt Olga also is interesting, the character, in representing this kind of idea of what Dietrich's character would become if she just carries on being a con artist and jewel thief.
Mm-hmm.
And Aunt Olga even gets this plot point about how she once upon a time fell in love and didn't feel that she could be with this person because of who she was, and didn't want to tell him the truth about herself. And so she represents this kind of vision of what the Dietrich character could be, and yet a vision of someone who seems to be doing okay, really.
Yeah, crime seems to be paying pretty well for her.
Yes. I mean, I do like the scene where Halliday's character does the magic tricks also as a way of getting hold of these pearls that have wound up in Gary Cooper's pocket. It's fun. I mean, he's a perfectly competent performer. It's just that he is really lacking in any kind of charm. And that seems to be the kind of roles that he played.
Mm-hmm.
That was his job, was to be the kind of cold, charmless person.
We have to deal with, at some point, the code.
Yes.
The big change between, I mean, I feel like I've said the big change 5 or 6 times because we're in a time of upheaval in the film industry and the world. Amongst those big changes is the change from essentially the code being a thing that was out there but relatively lackadaisically enforced to something that was a actively enforced imposition, self-imposed on a technical level, that was a going concern for filmmakers beyond a headache. And so this is the first motion picture production code era film of the podcast, Merry Widow being a truly transitional film because it was cut in post-production. And the version we have now is actually the pre-code version, which is incredibly lucky. But this is a film where we can really see the Joseph Breen of it all come crashing down on the industry in some ways, but also not in others. I do want to have a little asterisk here to say that the fact that these unmarried characters clearly off screen sleep together takes me back a little.
And it's particularly striking. I was going to bring up the same thing because the Breen office, so obviously all during this period, every script that was going to be filmed had to be submitted to this office run by Joseph Breen, and they would send it back with comments about what needed to be cut, what needed to be changed. And the censor's report said it must not be suggested that these two people sleep together. And yet, of course, in the film, it is extremely obvious that they do. I mean, there is this sort of morning after scene that is pretty unmistakable in what it's telling you. And so this film is a perfect example of how, yes, the code did have a real impact, but it's also surprising how much, even in this early period, films could still get away with. And it's kind of like, sometimes you get the sense that the censors maybe just were not picking up on what the films were doing. Obviously, that things could happen sort of between the lines. Sometimes I think the studios were just clever, or filmmakers were clever about sort of pretending they were going to do something and then sort of slipping it in after, you know, and getting away mm-hmm. with it. So obviously, there's two things going on in this film that are potentially problematic. There is the fact that you have these two people who clearly are having a sexual relationship before getting married. But also, of course, it is dealing with the protagonist being a criminal. And in this period, you could not have something like Trouble in Paradise, which ends with these two thieves and con artists going off together to carry on being criminals together and live happily ever after. And there is no punishment whatsoever. That, you know, was not allowed. So in this film, you know, there was an insistence that, you know, there had to be some kind of legal repercussions, and she had to return this necklace as, you know, as a sort of sign that she is definitely reformed. They managed to give it this kind of cute twist where they get married at the end and she pulls out her parole instead of her marriage license. They give it this kind of nice little Lubitsch touch, but she still has to reform and go off and be a wife in Detroit. She cannot continue to be a glamorous jewel thief. So it's certainly a code. It's a code era film. But in addition to the fact that they obviously sleep together, you know, the most kind of Lubitsch parts of this film in some ways are the interaction between Dietrich and Cooper earlier on, and all these kind of little things that are going on with her hand and his pocket. And, you know, there's these moments that are getting fairly racy at times.
You can feel everyone involved really trying to make the ending work, but the phrase "your debt to the state" doesn't really have a romantic sweep to it. Yeah, that's where I struggle the most with the film in terms of meeting it as its own work, because you can really feel just the hand of the filmmaker being forced there. You know, it doesn't feel germane to what the rest of the film is necessarily doing to me, aside from just they had to do it because it's written in the code. Crime has to be expressly shown to not pay, essentially. You can't portray a crime and not have some sort of justice be done as a result of it, although certain films did get away with it. One other little thing they don't quite sneak by, but I was a little surprised to see it this late date. It's pretty telling of how rapidly things change that just 5 years ago, Marlene Dietrich dressed as a man and kissed a woman in Morocco. But at this point, just the mere mention of cross-dressing, you know, where Dietrich says, "My husband, you know, wears women's clothes." I'd forgotten about that. That actively surprised me. I was like, wow, I cannot believe that actually got through. We've gone from actively portraying cross-dressing and two women kissing on screen. 5 years later, I'm shocked that there's cross-dressing in this diegetic world at all.
To what we were saying earlier on about the opening of the film feeling very Lubitsch, that whole scene where Dietrich goes to see Dr. Paquet, played by Alan Mowbray, and tells him this story about her husband. And she keeps saying, "Oh, it's too embarrassing to mention. Oh, I can't even say it." You know, and so she does mention him wearing nightgowns and so forth. But she also does a lot of this stuff where she kind of looks down and she looks up and she blinks and she makes, you know, and so she's sort of suggesting all these things that she can't even say that are going on with her husband. So it's also a kind of classic example of this way of sort of getting a sense across of what she's talking about without coming right out and saying anything that would have been, you know, unmentionable under the code.
There's almost a sense that they're still working out the social contract of what we might call the classic Hollywood era, where, you know, what we can show, what's unspeakable, what's not unspeakable. Even with that, it's still a shocking turn from the last few years of relative freedom. And you need only look at like the ending of, as you mentioned, Trouble in Paradise or also Jewel Robbery. It's a film where you're blown away by the cool act of thievery and of plying the cops with marijuana. And so the kind of fire and brimstone, unforgiving way that, you know, the Dietrich character has to do time feels almost mean-spirited. It's almost like the police have broken up the party.
Well, and we also lose something in this film from Trouble in Paradise and Jewel Robbery, which is in those earlier films, thievery and seduction are kind of going together. You know, there's this sense that thievery itself is almost a kind of act of seduction and vice versa. And, you know, you have obviously the famous opening of Trouble in Paradise with Gaston and Lily picking each other's pockets over this romantic dinner. You have William Powell kind of seducing Kay Francis with this, the excitement of watching him rob this jewelry store. So these two things are sort of feeding off of each other. And there is obviously robbery is being made sexy. And con artistry is sexy, which of course con artistry has to be sexy. And then you get to Desire, and instead you have this sense that it's like you can have one or the other, but they're actually opposed to each other. That this life that she leads of with the pearls and the sort of enjoyment of the deception is what she has to give up in order to have this romantic and sexual relationship with someone who has absolutely no respect whatsoever for what she has been and done. I mean, he's willing to forgive her, but it's like he loves her in spite of her being a thief instead of loving her, you know, because she is a thief, which in a way is the way it would have been in an earlier Lubitsch film. And maybe they would have gone off and carried on a life of crime together. This film obviously does make crime kind of attractive early on, but then that has to be clearly squelched at the end.
In Design for Living, the phrase immorality may be fun, but it's no replacement for 100% virtue and 3 square meals a day. That's looked upon with derision in Design for Living. And it almost feels like something resembling a film like this is mission statement in some ways, right? That, you know, it's both a shame and also very interesting. I always like watching films that only could have been made at the point they were made, where they are symptomatic of what was going on in society at the time. And so this is, if nothing else, a great example of one of those. So I think that makes it in some ways more valuable.
I don't know if you've already talked about Angel, because of course, Angel, which is the film that Dietrich makes with Lubitsch a year later, is very interesting for the way that it navigates the code in regard to the fact that her character may or may not have committed adultery, for which she is not in any way punished. But it becomes an entire film about how we can't be allowed to know certain things and everything has to be oblique and kind of, hidden and mysterious.
It's interesting. I mean, the subtext, Angel is so interesting because the subtext in that film is subterranean. It feels like an exercise in minimalism of doing the least amount possible to imply as much as possible. It's like the Lubitsch style taken to its logical extreme. And of course, it was therefore divisive when it came out. But yeah, no, this film compares so interestingly to that because even the Dietrich role in that feels almost like a step backwards. And I don't mean to say in a bad way, but it feels like her character there resembles her Sternberg self more than her character in this film, where her character in that film feels so remote from the other characters, from us, from any human understanding. To me, it makes perfect sense why that film was the one that partially provoked her to be labeled box office poison in 38.
I love Angel. It's easy to see why it was a film that was not embraced at the time.
It's a film made for Lubitsch diehards, it feels like, which is part of why I love it, too.
I do want us to give Borzaghi his due. And his film in 1937, he makes History is Made at Night.
That film is wild.
Which is a really wonderful film that has been also a kind of like cult favorite. And partly because for a long time it was not easy to see. It is now finally available, you know, from the Criterion Collection and on the Criterion Channel. But it's interesting what you said about Angel and minimalism. And History is Made at Night is this film that kind of winds up including, like, it's kind of everything but the kitchen sink.
Nautical disasters.
But it starts, you know, it goes from being drama about a woman with an abusive husband. Then it has this wonderful kind of, romantic comic sequence with Jean Arthur and Charles Boyer and this really wonderful kind of romantic idyll that they share. And then, yes, you get disasters at sea and it turns into this near tragedy. And if we're looking at desire as this moment where Lubitsch and Borzaghi intersect and, you know, you get a film that is sort of their shared sensibilities, their two films from 1937 kind of show the extreme difference in their sensibilities. Borzaghi, I mean, I know Scorsese wrote an introduction to a book about Borzaghi and says there's not an ironic moment in any of his films. If there is any, it's probably somewhere in Desire. But I mean, like there is this sincerity that he has and this real faith in melodrama and belief in kind of melodramatic turns that we might assume to be kind of ridiculous or far-fetched, but he can kind of sell them because he has this kind of deep emotional investment in the idea of the redemptive power of love. And, you know, Borzaghi's later career also is quite interesting.
Do you want to touch upon one later film he made, The Mortal Storm? That is such an interesting comparison to Be or Not to Be. To deal with something so hateful as the Nazis, Lubitsch kind of buries himself in an unprecedented amount of layers of irony. That film is about irony and its use, whereas The Mortal Storm is this completely sincere, just...
It's a plea for moral courage, I think, in the face of a society that is going down this road of fascism.
Exactly. It's just a very clear statement against ideological intolerance. There's not an ironic bone in that film's body as well. I mean, in the same way that To Be or Not to Be is built of nothing but irony.
As exemplified by Greenberg's speech, which is simultaneously the film's most sincere and its most ironic moment.
They both approach it from ways that I think speak to their very different even styles when approaching identical subject matter, more or less.
Yeah, that's a great comparison. And I mean, it is also just making me think, because you brought up at the very beginning of this, Lubitsch having lost his German citizenship and become an American citizen, that of course, Dietrich also would become an American citizen just a few years after this. And of course, would, you know, become this a tremendous heroine during World War II in her work in support of the Allies and all of the work that she did to, you know, entertaining the troops and supporting the Allied cause and the rift that that caused for her with the way that she was viewed in Germany, which lasted for decades. So, I mean, we haven't really talked very much about the relationship between Dietrich and Lubitsch. Part of what they had in common was this position of being exiles in this moment when they saw what was happening in their country, in their country of origin. And of course, they were in different positions. I mean, Lubitsch was Jewish, Dietrich was not. But Dietrich was really passionately anti-Nazi. Lubitsch's whole attitude towards politics is so fascinating because so many of his films so openly willing to sort of downgrade all these serious issues of world affairs and politics, and, you know, suggest that love and romance and sex and comedy are more important and are more central. And that's kind of what Angel is also partly about, because it is about how Herbert Marshall ultimately is going to, you know, blow off this peace conference to repair his relationship with his wife. And then you have Clooney Brown with Charles Boyer abandoning his role as this supposed, you know, freedom fighter, dissident, to go off and write, you know, pulp novels so that he can support this woman.
You know what you've done to me? I was going to write a book, Morality versus Expediency. With luck, I might have made barely enough money for myself. But now, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to write a bestseller, a murder mystery.
A murder mystery? What's it going to be about?
A murder.
So it's one of the ways in which Lubitsch is really radical. And I realize I've gotten way off track. So you can just cut that out if you want.
Oh, I love tangents. Tangents are my favorite things, but I completely agree. I mean, that was Krakauer's knock on Lubitsch, right? That he, instead of actually focusing on the actual politics of things, he was all about the bedroom antics of the leaders. And yet that was part of Lubitsch's genius, that he could still embed certain themes in that. I think that his work is a lot more political than it seems on the surface. He's only probably made 3 or 4 films that are overtly political, like Broken Lullaby, To Be or Not to Be, and Ninotchka to a certain degree. But the ending of Clooney Brown, I think, is such an interesting grace note on all this, right? Where that's the one moment in the Lubitsch film where I strongly suspect that a heavy element of autobiography plays into it. Although, I mean, you do have stuff like Shoe Palace Pincus and Shop Around the Corner too, which do have parallels in his life. But that ending, it is a tale of a high profile man driven out of his original country, although Lubitsch left long before any of that, to make popular art in the US. And isn't that great? And boy, I did it. And that's part of why the ending of that movie is so lovely to me.
But just to loop back to Desire for a moment,
this film, as we mentioned in the beginning, was, you know, the only film that Lubitsch would point to as, aha, look, if I had a second year as production head of Paramount, look at this success I brought, and isn't this a good movie? And yeah, he had a great point there. But either way, in February of 1936, he was unceremoniously fired, and his relationship with Paramount, which is the studio he, to this day, in the year 2023, nearly 2024, is the studio he is most associated with, and he was kind of tossed out on his rear end unceremoniously. He's told 4 or 5 different stories about how he found out. Probably none of them are true. But what we do know is he felt very sour about the whole thing. And he did end up making Angel in Bluebeard's 8th Wife with Paramount. But he quickly moved on to other studios. And the rest of his career was a slightly nomadic experience, at least in terms of his studios. He would work with MGM. He'd work with Fox. He'd try a couple of times, actually, to strike out on his own independently with people like Saul Lesser. But we're reaching the end, nearly, of, you know, one of the greatest pairings of a studio and a director ever. And the next decade of Lubitsch's life, which would be the last decade of his life, this comes 11 years before he passed away, would be, I think, a string of some of the best films I've ever seen, some of the best ones ever made. Imogen, thank you so much for making the time for the show and talking about one of our relatively rare non-Lubitsch films. Me and also eventually especially when this comes out in like 8 months, my audience will be so much the greater for having your knowledge contributed to this. So thank you so much.
Thank you. This was really fun.
Next week, Chris Cassingham joins us to discuss Angel. Head over to ErnstCast.com for information as to where you might find the films we'll be discussing this season and other resources such as show notes and our Discord server. How Would Lubitsch Do It is a production of Moving Image Agency. Brennan King was our dialogue editor for this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you happen to use. It helps other people find our podcast and therefore find Ernst Lubitsch. We'd like to acknowledge that this podcast was produced on the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples.